Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, one of the co-editors of Versus History. It's Patrick O'Shaughnessy. If you want to drop me a message on social media, it's at History Chappy. If you are partial to reviews, we'd love a five-star one. And if you could share it with your friends and family, that would be great. But the most important thing about today isn't that or me. It's Dr. James Crossland, who is joining us from Liverpool John Moores University, where he's a reader in international history. Well, that's quite a mouthful. James, welcome to Versus History.
Apologies for that. It is a bit much, isn't it? Yeah.
We will forgive you. You've got some very interesting specialisms. You've got a specialism in the history of terrorism, the laws of armed conflict, intelligence and propaganda. So lots of pens and guns.
As I put it to my students, I have a wide-ranging interest in lots of terrible things.
Very deftly put. Mm-hmm. I don't know if a laugh was the most appropriate thing.
No, you have to laugh. You have to laugh.
Absolutely. I know we're going to get to it at the end.
It's the only way through doing this stuff.
Oh, there we go. There we go. I know you've got a book out. So before, we're going to go to it sort of at the very, very end. But just tell us, it's called The Rise of Devils. That's a jolly interesting and somewhat anti-ecclesiastical name. I'll let you tell us all about it before we get into the questions.
Well, it's well pointed out, anti-ecclesiastical, because it's basically the idea of it comes from a quote from Pope Pius, who back in the 1870s said that he was talking about the Paris Communards who'd risen up and taken control of Paris there for a bit, and he said they are like devils risen up from hell. And it got me thinking about political violence during this period and how it was perceived. And I'd been thinking for some time about writing a book about the origins of terrorism. I've always had an interest in political violence. And I started thinking about taking things further back than where a lot of people start the history of terrorism. We can perhaps get into that a bit, but oftentimes you get narratives that put it in the 1890s, some even later than that. And I wanted to take it back as far as I could within reason and sort of figure out where the sinews of modern terrorism came from. And in the process, I plagiarized a Pope for the book title. So yes, the Rise of Devils is about the way in which modern terrorism and modern terrorists came to be.
Well, plagiarising a Pope, I don't know if it outdoes Henry VIII, but he got rid of one. Well, he didn't get rid of him, did he? But he certainly annulled his authority. Anyway, tell us a little bit about you, Jane. Tell us about your background. I mean, you've got lots of aspiring academics that listen in. How did you get to where you are now in a nutshell?
I'd always been interested in history. At a certain point, I decided I wanted to make a proper go of it and go right through, get the PhD, everything else. And I started by working on the laws of armed conflict as just something I found very interesting. And I guess the wider relationships between perceptions of violence, if there's a sort of recurring thread in my research, it is about how people have perceived different forms of violence. And I started with the regulation of violence through things like the Geneva Convention. And then I got more interested in psychological warfare as well, propaganda, intelligence, and so forth. And then from there into political violence. So I've done a couple of books on the origins of basically the laws of war. But I wanted, as I say, because I'd been nursing the idea for some time to turn towards a history of terrorism and to put it all together. And that was what I started doing maybe 4 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, something like that now. And the result was Rise of Devils.
Question for you to get the ball rolling with the substantive content is, what was it about the mid-19th century or the mid-1800s that led to the development of terrorism? I mean, guess my students in my classes, we learn about lots of tarring and feathering in the American colonies. So I guess that's a form of terrorism of sorts, depending which way you look at it. But what was it about the mid-1800s that kicked everything off?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of using violence as a either in practice or as a threat to try to alter someone's politics or their culture, society, you know, big wider outcomes. That's been around for millennia. You can find forms of terrorism going back, you know, 2000 years. But I was interested in, I guess, the development of, again, it's about perception of the modern terrorist, the guy with the bomb, who will set off that bomb in a public place, and hurt or kill innocent people to further some kind of political objective. And although those figures had been around before, throughout history, it's really in the mid 19th century that you start to see this recognizable type emerge. And what I put it down to a couple of things. Firstly, you have a specific incident that takes place in 1858 when there's an Italian nationalist by the name of Felice Orsini who attempts to murder Emperor Napoleon III of France, and he does so using an improvised explosive device that he makes himself. It's a grenade. It's a shrapnel grenade that comes to be known as the Orsini bomb. And whilst on paper this looks like a typical regicide, you know, political assassination, kill an emperor, kill a king, been happening for centuries, as I say, Orsini makes this weapon, which is going to hurt other people when it's detonated in the vicinity of the emperor. He assembles a team of bombers to deploy it. There's meant to be four bombs thrown. Three are thrown in the end. One of them loses his bottle towards the go time. And so three of these bombs get thrown into a packed crowd around Emperor Napoleon III's carriage. And the bombers do this knowing full well that it's going to hurt and indeed kill innocent people, which it does. It kills about eight people and wounds over 100 others. The emperor himself was fine. And I thought to myself, well, why did they do that? And I realized that there was this other thing that was happening at this time, was that you had the development of mass media. You had the lifting of restrictions on what could and could not be published in a number of European countries. You had telegraph lines being laid and undersea telegraph cables as well. So bringing together information across continents and the sort of start of a global information network that underpinned an explosion of newspapers and different types of periodicals that really ramps up throughout the remaining decades of the 19th century. And lo and behold, Orsini's bomb catches a lot of attention, gets a lot of headlines. He becomes quite a notorious figure across the globe. He's lauded by radicals across the globe for both his bomb and for the example he set in trying to challenge a defiant emperor in such a brazen way. And I think the third aspect, which kind of ties to this story as well, is this is an era of weapons technology and innovation in weapons technology. You've got a series of wars from the Crimean War through the wars of German and Italian unification. And then finally on to the wars in South Africa towards the end of the century. And there's a lot of innovation in these conflicts. The American Civil War as well needs to be mentioned there, in terms of explosives, machine guns, new types of weapons. Chemical warfare is experimented with for the first time during this period in a modern way. So I think access to new weapons, the ability to seize the attention of the media, which is vital for terrorism. You've got to publicize your act of violence. Otherwise, you can't make anyone scared of what you've done. You can't convey your political message either. And just Orsini's example as well, which is really influential in the decades that followed amongst various violent radical groups. So I think there's a perfect storm there that really kicks off this first age of terror.
In short, the Industrial Revolution really upped the ante when it came to terrorism. Okay, The next question. Who were the terrorists of this era then, and why did they think bombs and assassinations may be the answer to their political grievances?
Well, they also, to go back to the Orsini's example, he's a case in point of a type of violent radical during this period who looks at the failure of traditional revolution, you know, get on the streets, get a posse together, get into street fighting with the police, throw up barricades, the traditional, you know, French Revolution style thing. That doesn't seem to be working anymore. And the failed revolutions across Europe in 1848 kind of prove that. And so you get this generation of radicals who say, well, we need another way forward. And Orsini is kind of a pioneer there because he comes up with the notion that you don't need a horde of the disenfranchised marching down the street with pikes and rifles, you know, looking to engage a state and its army. All you need are some men with bombs and the resolve to terrify a populace with them. And that idea takes root across a number of different groups that I look at in Rise of Devils, who are all basically coming to this realization at about the same time. There are in Russia, the nihilists, who are a loose group, who are pledged to the ending of Tsardom and the creation of a new Russian state that's a departure from the Russia of the Tsars and the Church. You have the Irish Republicans, who end up unleashing the first proper terrorist campaign on British soil in the 1880s. There's this turn to terrorism that occurs in the thinking of a number of Fenian leaders in the 1870s, and that manifests in what historians call the Dynamite War of the 1880s, which is about comprises about 15 bombings across across Britain. Manchester, London, Liverpool, Glasgow are bombed, amongst other places. And then you've also got nationalists. You've got anarchists, who are probably the biggest group, violent radical group of this period, who really start engaging in terrorism, I'd say from the mid-1880s onwards. And you really get a kind of anarchist panic in the 1890s because the spread of not just the anarchist ideology, but people willing to commit violence in the name of that ideology is genuinely global. There are anarchist attacks in South America, in North America, across Europe, Russia, Asia, India, Australia, anarchist attacks everywhere. So all these groups all, and this is something I try to get into in Rise of Devils, is looking at individuals and how they interact with each other, how they're communicating with one another, how they're reading about each other's exploits in the newspapers and saying, oh, this guy might be a Fenian and I might be an anarchist. We've got different ideological goals, but I can see what they're doing. I can see that that makes sense. I can see how that might work for me. And so I try to not really get too caught up in the ideology, because I don't think during this period it mattered too much. I think what mattered was that the terrorists were learning the tactics of terrorism, learning how to do terrorism from each other.
Thank you. Okay, the next question, this reminds me of when Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, I think it was Thatcher anyway, it must have been if it was the 1980s, she banned the voices of Sinn Féin leaders, Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, I think anyone from Sinn Féin, on British television or in British media. So the question for you is, what role did the media play in spreading terrorist ideas? Because obviously in the 80s, she tried to stop any Irish nationalism, terrorism or not, being on any sort of British, I guess, media avenue or platform.
It's funny because today we look at our media and we complain a lot about how reckless it is and how scandalous reportage is and fake news and all this kind of stuff. And not to defend the media of today and say that it's robust and fact-checked and everything else, but as compared to how the media worked in the late 19th century, it's a completely different ballgame. This stuff happening in the late 19th century was just out-and-out fabrication in the press about who the terrorists are, why they're committing acts of terrorism, where they're getting their weapons from, who they're talking to, what their plans are. Just flat out lies. And one of the big things that runs through Rise of Devils, and I kind of chronicle how it evolves over this period, because this is a golden age of conspiracy theories as well, of various sorts across the world. And one of the ones that becomes very pervasive, really from the 1870s onwards, is this idea that there are terrorists in various forms. They can call themselves anarchists, socialists, nihilists, whatever, you know, whatever kind of ist they claim to be. And they are everywhere across the world, all claiming different allegiances to different causes, but fundamentally they're all the same. And they're all in it together. And there's also, and there's some kind of vast network of these people who are talking with each other, plotting with each other, conspiring with each other. And this is a pervasive theory that the press peddles to explain why there's so many attacks happening. And it's one in a very damaging way that gets picked up by a number of police. And for various reasons, it's part of inflating a threat to increase your budget and your range of powers, which is, you know, a pretty common process. But at the same time, there are some members of law enforcement during this period, as well as some politicians, who I think genuinely buy into this idea that there's some vast conspiracy at play. And there's this this symbiotic relationship between the press, the police, the and the terrorists themselves that, that kind of fuels that. So the media are vital for that. They're also vital for, as I say, spreading knowledge of the terrorist attacks themselves, which there are many examples in Rise of Devils where I look at a terrorist who's picked up a radical magazine, usually, or sometimes just a regular newspaper, where they've reported on this other terrorist attack, and they've given some pretty explicit details, you know, the type of bomb used, what they were trying to achieve, et cetera, et cetera. And the person reading it has said, well, that sounds great. I'm going to go do that myself. So the glorification and the detail and the kind of hyperbole that's attached to the reportage, I think, plays a big part in encouraging cycles of terrorism during this period.
How did the police respond to terrorist attacks? So they were infiltrating terrorist groups, potentially, perhaps, reconnaissance, et cetera, over to you.
Yeah, the police, generally speaking, and this is about contextualization, thinking about the fact that they're dealing with a pretty new threat. And so depending on the country, and I look at a number of countries in the book, and they've all got different ways of approaching it. Some countries, Russia and France in particular, really respond in an overzealous fashion by rounding up anyone who's ever said anything bad about the emperor, throwing him in jail, assuming that they're involved in acts of violence, even if they're not. So you get some very draconian, sweeping sort of dragnet responses. Over time, there's a bit more refinement to the way in which counterterrorism evolves, and it becomes, if not, it becomes more effective and more sinister, in that you get a greater use of agents provocateurs and infiltrators, informers. You get some police really getting deeply involved in provoking terrorism through to the extent that they're encouraging their own encouraging different radical groups to go out and set off bombs and so forth. So you do get varying responses. It's not really until 1898, this very important conference in Rome, where police chiefs from across Europe and some politicians, military figures as well, get together and say, right, you know, this anarchist problem is out of control. And what spurs this is the stabbing to death of Empress Elizabeth of Austria in 1898. She's killed on the shores of Lake Geneva by an anarchist, and she's a much beloved monarch. And this prompts this thought that, well, we need to work together across borders. We need to exchange information. We need to develop a definition of what we think a terrorist is and try to stick to it, irrespective of if we're talking about France, Spain, Italy, wherever. And this meeting in Rome in 1898 really lays the foundations for norms of international policing that exist to this day, in the way in which intelligence services and police will exchange information on international criminals, which terrorists generally fall into that category. So it's both a formative period for the development of terrorism and also really important for the development of counterterrorism. Both the terrorists and the police who are pursuing them are both on learning curves that very much feed off each other during this period.
What do you think were the similarities and potential differences between the first, quote unquote, war on terror of the late 1800s and the more recent 21st century version?
Well, the idea of a war on terror in the late 19th century is it's different. I'll go with the differences first. The difference is, so the war on terror that we know, that we think of when we think war on terror, it's George W. Bush proclaiming it in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. So you've got a president of a country that's been attacked saying there is going to be this thing called a war on terror. It's not really well defined. Over time, it evolves into there's coalitions of the willing, and there's various other catchphrases that are sort of thrown in. But the basic premise is that those nations that are against terrorism will band together to fight terrorists, however we may wish to define them. That's a whole other conversation about the contemporary war on terror. And in the case of the 19th century version, it is similar in that it is very ill-defined. And the way in which terrorists are defined is also very arbitrary and capricious. There's basically a decision made at the 1898 conference in Rome that anyone who's an anarchist is a terrorist, and a terrorist is an anarchist, even though there's many, many anarchists who are not involved in terrorism. In fact, by this point, there's a number of anarchists who are outright condemning terrorism. They're saying that the idea of going out and setting off bombs in public places, which had been happening across Europe during the 1890s, anarchists had bombed theaters and cafes and police stations and shopping malls and much else besides. This idea of going out and trying to create fear and hurt innocent people in the process is actually making anarchism look bad. So you've got a critique within the anarchist movement itself of terrorism. Similar debates actually happen in the Irish Republican cause as well. It's not like everyone with a some sort of radical agenda is suddenly moving towards terrorism. There are debates there, but all nuance is stripped aside by the police and certain politicians of this period, who look at it in a very blanket term and say, if you're believing in these ideologies, you must be a terrorist. And so there's a similarity there in the kind of blanket demonizations that occurred during the contemporary war on terror. What's different, though, I think, about the 19th century war on terror is that it's not really declared. There is something akin to what George W. Bush did, but it comes from the New York Times, who in 1881 published this condemnation of what's probably the most notorious terrorist attack of this period. When Tsar Alexander II is killed by a suicide bomber on the streets of St. Petersburg by a Russian nihilist. And this makes global headlines. It's a global event. And the New York Times calls for a war on terrorism. So they use more correct verbiage than Bush did, but it's the same basic principle. They say we need to have a war on terrorism. And it takes time for that to evolve. So I think the main difference is in the 19th century, it's this more piecemeal thing where it's being cobbled together through different police agencies and different politicians, some who are in favor of it, some who are not. And the idea of some crusade against terrorism isn't quite so black and white and clearly defined as it was during the aftermath of 9/11. But the same kind of results ensue, where you get sort of overreaction, you get threat inflation, you get demonization of minorities. And that was what was really quite striking writing this book, was just how much of it felt familiar, even though I'm talking about stuff that happened 120 odd years ago. So much of it was eerily familiar for someone who had grown up in the shadow of September 11th.
Final question for you, and it's one that potentially historians hate. They tend to hate counterfactuals and also questions about the future, because I guess it's the one thing they can't see. But I think it was Thucydides that said something akin to historians can't lobotomize citizenship. And Tim Snyder, the American historian, said, history can warn. So, what's the future for terrorism, do you think?
I mean, sad to say, it's never going away, because it is the simplest form of striking if you are aggrieved about whatever it is you're aggrieved about. It's the simplest way of striking back. Differences today that make it, I think, easier to contain and harder to pull off is that policing has gotten better. There is a acknowledgement that there is a particularly a race online between the way in which police can track terrorists and the way in which terrorists can evade police tracking them. That's an ongoing process. Something that's very different to the period that I was looking at, where it was very much, systems and ideas and concepts of how to actually fight terrorism were in their nascent stages. These days, there's obviously 120 odd years worth of experience to draw on, and that does make a difference. I also think the media, for all of its problems today, is a lot better in the way it reports on terrorism, which, as I say, is one of the key things I delve into in Rise of Devils, is this idea that the media does perpetuate a lot of this stuff and does a lot more harm than good in its reportage during this period. I think there are moments where the media today does sometimes forget about that, and there is some reckless reportage, but by and large, the way in which terrorist attacks are reported on, everything from the motive to the means to who's involved and why, there are better standards, let's say, today than there used to be. And that, I think that does make a pretty big difference in terms of fostering further attacks. But no, I mean, as a phenomenon, as I say, terrorism has been around since the start of recorded history. You can go back to ancient Judea, the Sicarii going around stabbing Roman officials. You can take it back thousands of years. The concept is always going to be there, but the means of limiting it, I think, have certainly gotten better than the period in the Rise of Devils covers.
Thanks, James. Well, here comes the big sell. I know your new book is published by Manchester University Press. It's not the first book from Manchester University Press that we've had an interview with the author on the podcast. We had Casper Melville, who's a doctor at School of Oriental and African Studies, with his book on How Rare Groove, Acid House and Jungle Drum and Bass Remapped the City. Yours is slightly different, although there's some urban themes there, I guess. Tell us all about it. And where can we get hold of it, and when can we get hold of it?
It is available now pretty much everywhere, from what I can gather, for a svelte £20. Yeah, out there, easy to get hold of. It is a book that, as I say, is looking at a big idea, the origins of terrorism, through a narrative. I focus a lot on the people who were involved in this, terrorists, philosophers, murderers, criminals, spies, politicians. I try to see this world through their eyes as much as possible, and sort of map their interactions with one another and how they learn from each other. So it's a story ultimately about individuals creating pretty wretched ideas. But it is, I think, an important story because it gives us, it gave me, at least writing it, a lot of perspective on terrorism today, and a lot of an informed perspective, I hope, on just what it is and the form it takes and how we should perhaps react to it.
Thank you. And finally, before we let you have your freedom, if there are any readers or listeners out there that want to get in touch with you, question, argue, debate, whatever, how can they do it?
They can find me on Twitter at Dr. J. Crossland. That's J, the initial, Crossland. And I post regularly stuff, usually oddities of terrorist history, because there are a lot from this time period in particular. But follow me on there. Give me a shout out.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.